It's almost more than 2 decades, I believe, that when you first came to South America. And you came there as an anthropologist, a Marxist anthropologist.
Correct.
With probably a set of beliefs and what you can do for those people over there.
Exactly.
How you can help them. But since then, you embarked on an investigation we could sum it up as what intelligence really is. And of course, you saw that there are different perspectives and means to attain intelligence. And maybe if we could start off with what kind of intelligence people in the Amazon, in the Amazon basin where you've been and spent quite a lot of years have, and how does it differ from the Western perspective?
Well, it's true that in the Amazon, the indigenous people who live there, when they look at plants and animals, they see something other than what many Western people have seen in recent centuries. In other words, the approach to knowledge here in the West has put an emphasis on objectivity. And in fact, what that word means is relative to the object. So we have treated plants and animals like objects with our objective knowledge. Well, in the Amazon, they see plants and animals as persons, as having personalities. Each species obviously has a different personality, and as filled with intelligence. So they do not have a mechanical view of nature. They have a intersubjective, personal view of nature. They do not put a boundary between humans and other species. In fact, they ascribe humanity to all the other species. So there's no artificial, arbitrary line somehow cutting humans off from other species. And that's one of the first things that's interesting, is that when you go towards a radically different way of looking at the world, you come up upon your own presuppositions or the limits of your own system of knowledge. In other words, when you, as an anthropologist, live with people who think that plants and animals are people, then you have to think, okay, well, in my culture, we don't do it that way. In fact, in my culture, we have a whole list of characteristics that we think make us different from other species. So, and actually, it's what's interesting is that in recent years, science itself has been reconsidering the list of what is specific to humans. Western culture, Judeo-Christian rationalist culture, has been obsessed with what is specific to humans. So there's a list of only humans make tools, humans have intelligence, humans can are capable of abstraction. These are the kinds of things that we're supposed to make us unique. It turns out that science has demonstrated recently that even invertebrate bees with brains the size of a grain of salt can handle abstract concepts. Even birds can make standardized tools with hooks. All species communicate, I mean, maybe not in a European language. Actually, plants do a lot of their communication with chemistry. You know, so it's not a human language, it's with chemicals. It turns out that the signals, the cells in our own body also communicate with approximately 11,000 molecular signals. So anyway, when as a Westerner you end up in the Amazon dealing with a different approach to understanding the world we're in, it does make you reconsider how we know, how we look at things, what is knowledge, what is a plant, how do I know what I know about a plant, about an animal, or about myself. So, yeah, the experience of going to the Amazon and living with indigenous Amazonian people and trying to understand how they think about nature and humanity's place in nature has been extremely stimulating.
Maybe it's also meaningful to mention we don't need to have such a clear cut between the Western culture and shamanism to see this difference in perceiving intelligence. In your newest book, Intelligence in Nature, you also talk about the Japanese science and their means of trying to understand nature and how they investigate chimpanzees, which mm-hmm. is completely different than mm-hmm. the Western perspective.
Yes, well, actually, not just Japanese scientists, but also scientists in the West in recent years or even recent decades have started breaking away from the mechanical, objectifying view of nature and have started to investigate how amoebas can solve mazes or well, how bees can handle abstract concepts, or even just how a blade of grass goes about being a blade of grass. In fact, integrating all kinds of information about its circumstances and transducing it into electrochemical information that its cells send one another. It turns out that a blade of grass operates in a very similar way to the way that a human brain operates. And this is the data that science is now revealing. One could say that science has reached sufficient sophistication as to be generating data that calls into question its own presuppositions. Mm-hmm. It is true that, for example, Japanese scientists asked questions of nature several decades before Western scientists because they were not coming out of a Judeo-Christian tradition. Actually, in Japan, the cultural presuppositions is Shintoist animist. For Japanese people, there never was an arbitrary boundary between humans and other species, and they have always ascribed a capacity to know, which they call chi-sei, to other species. It just seems obvious that monkeys and any living species has a capacity to know in Japanese culture. And so, for example, in the study of primates, of monkeys and so on, already in the 1940s and 1950s, Japanese primatologists were studying individual monkeys and thinking of them as individuals and seeing kinship. I mean, kinship was supposed to be something that only human beings had. That's what Western scientists presupposed. And when Japanese scientists said, no, one can also study a group of macaques as if they were humans and look at their kinship relations, in the West, everybody said, that's crazy. You know, that kinship is only human. But it turns out that the Japanese scientists were right, and that many of the things that that these monkeys do is articulated through kinship. I mean, one thing that it was thought that only humans have culture. In other words, behaviors that you can learn and transmit. Well, the Japanese started observing monkeys that would invent techniques and then teach them to the members of their kin group. And, you know, the evidence was just the evidence. There's a famous case of the researchers would give potatoes to these monkeys living in the wild. The potatoes would get covered in sand. And so potatoes were new, obviously, to these macaques. One macaque was observed figuring out that if you floated the potatoes in water, you could get rid of the sand, and then you could eat them. And then this macaque was observed showing this technique to other macaques. And so what we had is the innovation, the discovery of a new technique, and its transmission, in other words, culture. And the Japanese scientists discovered the existence of animal culture decades before Westerners thought it was even a possibility or a legitimate question. Now it's become an official subject of research. That's also one of the beauties of science. I mean, science certainly carries the prejudices of the culture out of which it has emerged. But science is also, it's first and foremost the endeavor to stick to the data. So, you know, when you see enough monkeys learning behaviors and transmitting it, and enough birds that are making tools, and enough bees that are clearly handling abstract concepts, then at that point, science has to admit that that this exists. And I think actually that for Westerners, one of the ways of breaking out of the limits of our own culture is to use our way of going about knowledge, which is science, and using, putting ourselves in front of what science has revealed and thinking about it. I mean, you know, one thing that since Darwin, but also since the molecular biology of the 20th century, that has become clear through science is that we have kinship with every other species in the world. It is a literal truth that the DNA molecules in my cells are copies of copies of copies of DNA
molecules that go all the way back to a bacterium 4 billion years ago, and that this whole chain of biological life that has been existing on Earth all this time is actually my family, and that I am connected to them all through kinship. That, you know, and so this is actually what shamans and animists have been saying for thousands of years. And science is now confirming this and revealing this. Mm-hmm.
And maybe before we go more deeply into this question of DNA, which you've investigated extensively, is, well, one way of finding DNA was through a microscope, and many have linked the tool of the shamans, which you're also acquainted with quite well, ayahuasca, a mixture of at least two plants, to be also a microscope in some ways, and to go even further than the metaphor for the microscope for the shaman. Mm-hmm. So could you explain what ayahuasca is for the shamans in, for instance, the tribe that you've spent so much time with, the Ashaninka?
Yeah, well, when you go and hang out with, for example, Ashaninka Indians in the Peruvian Amazon, and you ask them how they know what they know about plants, for example, they say, we have ayahuasqueros or tabaqueros or shamans, and they take ayahuasca, which is a hallucinogenic plant mixture, or they eat tobacco concentrate, and this gives them visions. And in their visions, what they perceive are the essences that are common to all life forms and that are sources of information. And they associate these essences with a form that historians of religion call the axis mundi, and that is shaped like a twisted ladder or two entwined serpents. Ayahuasca in the Amazonian approach to knowledge is the main tool that allows you to get in touch with the reality that is under the surface of appearances and that somehow determines our lives. It allows you to transcend the communication barrier that separates us from other species and to not only perceive their essence, but to communicate with them. So it is the number one tool for gaining knowledge about plants and animals. And it's exactly analogous to what a microscope is to a biologist. So it's the primordial tool for gaining knowledge about other species.
Could you say also, there's been a lot of discussion today, they say that it's all the same. You've written a book, 500 Years of Shamanism, mm-hmm. and you've gone through a lot of different cultures mm-hmm. where shamanism has been around and still is. These tools, from breathing techniques to dancing to meditation yeah. to eating some substance, uh-huh. how do they differ in their essences, in their effects?
Yeah. Well, that's a good question. I think it needs unpacking a little bit. In fact, shamanism is a creation of anthropologists and European observers. It's a label that has been put on many different techniques from many different cultures in many different environments. And it corresponded historically to what Europeans didn't understand. So anything involving trance states attained by different means that seem to be the contrary of rational knowledge, we're going to call it shamanism. And it kind of looks like a coherent thing, but it's actually many different techniques. As an anthropologist who works in the Amazon with indigenous people in trying to help them protect their territories and their systems of knowledge, it's true that my main experience with these questions has been with the Amazonian techniques, which are really centered on the use of psychoactive plants. And the Western Amazon is no doubt the world capital of hallucinogenic plants and their use for knowledge by indigenous people. I don't really have experience with other so-called shamanic techniques. I haven't been to Australia. I don't know about the Dreamtime. I haven't been to Siberia. I haven't practiced drumming. I've read some books and so on. But to answer your question, I would quote the anthropologist Michael Harner and what he told me. He is the first anthropologist to have written about his ayahuasca experience. He lived with Jivaroan and Shipibo people in the late 1950s and early 1960s, and that's where he was initiated to shamanism through ayahuasca. And then he became interested in shamanism this way. He wanted to find a technique that would not require the use of a plant or a substance, or let's call it a drug. And so he studied Siberian technique of inducing trance through a hypnotic drum beat. And he made a kind of transcultural method of neo-shamanism, which is the Harner method, and it's based on banging on a drum in a certain rhythm and going into a trance that way and visualizing rhythmically inspired visualization is the technique. Well, I asked him how he compares the two methods, and he said, well, ayahuasca no doubt is a shortcut, and it also allows you to go in deeper. Yes, it's similar. You go into trance, but the trance that you go into with the ayahuasca is deeper than the one that you go into with the drum, and that is no doubt why you see more reptiles and serpents with the ayahuasca than you do with the drum. So, if Michael Harner says so, I guess it's true.